Usher, the Tantra Vision,
Volume 1, talks on the Royal Song of Saraha, given at the Osho Commune International,
Pune, India.
Discourse number 5. Bhagwan, to a fly that likes the smell of putrid meat, the fragrance of sandalwood is foul. Beings who discard nirvana covet coarse samsara's realm. An ox's footprints filled with water will soon dry up. So with a mind that's firm but full of qualities that are not perfect, these imperfections will in time dry up. Like salt sea water that turns sweet when drunk up by the clouds, so a firm mind that works for others turns the poison of sense objects into nectar. If ineffable, never is one unsatisfied. If unimaginable, it must be bliss itself. Though from a cloud one fears the thunderclap, crops ripen when from it pours the rain.
Man is a myth, and the most dangerous myth. Because if you believe that man exists, then you don't try to evolve the man at all. There is no need. If you believe that you are already a man, then all growth stops. You are not already a man. You are just a potentiality to be. You can be. You may not be. You may miss. Remember, it can be missed. Man is not born. It is not a given fact. You cannot take it for granted. It is just a possibility. Man exists as a seed, not as a tree, not yet. Man is not yet actual. And the difference between the potential and the actual is great. Man, as he exists, is just a machine. Yet he works. Yet he succeeds in the world. Yet he lives a so-called life and dies. But remember, he exists not. His function is that of a mechanism. He is a robot. Man is a machine. Yes, this machine can grow something in it which can go beyond mechanism. This machine is no ordinary machine. It has tremendous potentiality to go beyond itself. It can produce something transcendental to its own structure. Sometimes it has produced a Buddha, a Christ, a Gurdjieff. Sometimes it has produced a man. But you don't believe that you are already a man. If you believe, your belief will be suicidal. Because once we believe that something is already there, then we stop looking for it. Then we stop creating it. Then we stop discovering it. Then we stop evolving it. Just think, an ill person, seriously ill person, thinks he is healthy. Why he should go to the doctor? Why he should take any medicine? Why he should go under treatment? Why he should be willing to go to the hospital? He believes he is healthy. He is in perfect health. And he is dying. His belief will kill him. That's why I say this myth is very dangerous. The most dangerous myth ever evolved by the priests and the politicians, that man is already on the earth. These millions of people on the earth are just possibilities. And unfortunately, majority of them are never going to become actual. Unfortunately, many of them will die as machines. What do I mean when I say man is a machine? I mean that man lives out of the past. Man lives out of a dead structure. Man lives out of habit. Man lives a life of routine. Man goes on moving in the same circle, in the same rut, again and again and again. Can't you see the vicious circle in your life? The same things you have been doing every day. Hoping, being angry, desiring, being ambitious, being sensual, sexual, being frustrated, again hoping, again the whole circle moves. Each hope brings to a frustration, never it is otherwise. And after each frustration, a new hope, and the circle starts moving. In the East, we call it the wheel of samsara. It is a wheel. The spokes are the same. And you are deluded by it again and again. You again start hoping. And you know you have hoped before. You have hoped millions of times. And nothing happens out of that hope. Just the wheel goes on moving and goes on killing you, goes on destroying your life. Time is running out of your hands. Each moment that is lost forever. And you go on repeating the old. And this is what I mean when I say man is a machine. I agree with George Gurdjieff absolutely. He used to say that you don't have a soul yet. He was the first man to say it so drastically. That you don't have a soul yet. Yes, the soul can be born in you. But you will have to give birth to it. You will have to become capable to give birth to it. Down the centuries, the priests have told you, you have already that soul. That you are already that man. That is not so. You are only potentially so. You can become actually too, but the myth has to be destroyed. See the fact of it. You are not a conscious being. And if you are not a conscious being, how can you be a man?
What is the difference between a rock and you? What is the difference between an animal in you? What is the difference between a tree and you? The difference is that of consciousness. But how much consciousness you have? Just a flicker here and there. Just sometimes, in rare moments, you become conscious. And that is only for seconds, and again you fall back into unconsciousness. Yes, sometimes it happens, because it is your potentiality. Sometimes it happens in spite of you. One day, the sun is rising, and you fall into tune with existence, and suddenly it is there. The beauty of it, the benediction of it, the fragrance of it, the light of it. Suddenly it is there, and you have a taste of what it would be, what it can be, what it is. But the moment you become alert that it is there, it is already gone. Only a memory is left. Only for rare moments, sometimes in love, sometimes watching a full moon, sometimes a rising sun, sometimes sitting in a silent mountain cave, sometimes looking at a child playing, giggling, yes, sometimes in music, but these moments are rare. If an ordinary man, the so-called man, achieved 7 moments of awareness in his whole life, that will be too much. Rarely, very rarely, just a ray enters and then it is gone. And you are back to your trivial life, dull and dead. And this is not so only with ordinary people. It is so with your so-called extraordinary people. Just the other day I was reading about Carl Jung. One of the greatest psychologists of this age. But sometimes one wonders whether to call these people psychologists or not. He was a very restless man. Absolutely restless. He could not sit silently for a single moment. He will turn and toss. He will do something or other. If there was nothing to do, he will smoke his pipe. And he was a chain smoker. Then he had a heart attack. And the doctors stopped smoking. Absolute stop. Now it was very much difficult. He started feeling his restlessness too much. He started feeling crazy. He will walk up and down in the room. He will go outside for no reason. He will sit in this chair and the other. And then he recognized the fact that the pipe has been very much helpful. It was a release, sort of release of his restlessness. So he asked the doctors, "Can I put the empty pipe in my mouth? Is it allowed? Empty pipe. That will help me." He was allowed. And then for years he used to put the empty pipe in his mouth. Just pretending that as if he is smoking. And then he will look the pipe, will keep the pipe in the hand, will play with the pipe. And this is about a great psychologist of this age. What unconsciousness! So much in the grip of the habit, so much in the grip of the unconscious, looks very childish. And then we go on finding rationalizations. Then we go on pretending ourselves. Then we go on protecting and defending ourselves, that why we are doing this. At the age of 45, Carl Jung fell in love with a woman. He was a married man, with a very loving wife. Nothing was wrong, but must be the restlessness. It almost always happens that near about the age 45, one starts feeling that the whole life is gone. Death is coming closer. And because of the death coming closer, either you become spiritual or you become more sexual. These are the only two defense. Either you turn in search for truth, for the eternal, which will have no death, or you start drowning yourself into more erotic fantasies. And particularly intellectuals, those who have lived their whole life through the head, are more victims at the age 45. Then the sexuality takes a revenge. It has been denied. Now death is coming closer. And then one never knows whether you will be here again or not, whether life will be there or not. Death is coming here. And you have lived a life of the head. Sexuality erupts with a vengeance. Carl Gustav Jung fell in love with a young woman. Now it was very much against his prestige. The wife was disturbed. And the wife had loved him tremendously and trusted him. He rationalized it beautifully. Look at his rationalization. That's how unconscious man goes on living. He will do something unconsciously, then will try to rationalize it and will try to prove that it is not unconscious. I am doing it very consciously. In fact, it has to be done. What he did? He developed suddenly a theory that there are two types of women in the world. One, the mother type, the caring type, the wife type, and the other, the mistress type, the beloved, who becomes an inspiration. And man needs both. And certainly a man like Carl Gustav Jung certainly needs both. He needs inspiration too. He needs a caring woman that his wife is fulfilling. She is loving a mother type. But that doesn't fulfill his need. He needs an inspiration too. He needs a romantic woman too, a mistress, which can take him into deep dreams. That is a must for him. He developed this theory. This is the rationalization. Now, he never developed the other part of it, that men are two types. That's where you can find that it is a rationalization. If it was really insight, then the other part, that men are two types, the father type and the lover type. And Jung's wife needs two. If Jung thinks that he is a lover type, then she needs the father type. If Jung thinks he is a father type, then she needs a lover type. But that he never developed. That's how you can see it is not an insight. It is just tricky mind, a rationalization. We go on rationalizing. We do things unconsciously. We do them without knowing why we are doing them. But we cannot accept the fact. It is very humiliating to accept that I have been doing something which I am not aware, which I don't know why. Beware of rationalizations. And how such people can be beneficial to others. It is a well-known fact that many of Carl Jung's patients committed suicide. Why? They had come to be helped. Why they committed suicide? Something must be basically wrong. His analysis is just lousy. He is a very arrogant man, very egoistic. Continuously ready to fight. Maybe his whole psychoanalysis has developed only as his arrogance against Sigmund Freud. Maybe it is again just a rationalization. Because he himself seems to be suffering from the same problems he is thinking to help others. He was always afraid of ghosts. Even in his old age, he was afraid of ghosts. He did not publish his most important book while he was alive because he was afraid that people will come to know the facts. So his memoirs are published. He made it certain that this would be published only when he is dead. Now, what type of truth and authenticity? He was so much afraid of found being wrong or in the wrong that he never allowed any fact to be disclosed about his life while he was alive. I was reading one anecdote. A man came to a psychiatrist and proceeded to unfold before the doctor his life story, covering his childhood experiences, his emotional life, his eating habits, his vocational problems, and everything else he could think of. Well, said the doctor, it does not seem to me as though there were anything wrong with you. You seem as sane as I am. But doctor, protested the patient, a note of horror creeping into his voice, it is these butterflies. I can't stand them. They are all over me. For heaven's sake, cried the doctor, recoiling, don't brush them off on me. The patients and the doctors all are in the same boat. The psychoanalyst and the analyzed are not very far away. It is a game. Maybe the psychoanalyst is more clever. But not that he knows the reality. Because to know the reality, you will have to become tremendously conscious. There is no other way. It is not a question of intellectual thinking. It has nothing to do by our philosophizing. To know reality, one has to grow into awareness. Gurdjieff used to talk about a future psychology. He used to say that psychology still exists not, because how it can exist? Even man exists not. When man is not there, how can there be a science about man? First the man has to exist, then the science about the man can exist. Right now whatsoever exists is not psychology. Maybe it is something about the machine. The man is. Psychology can exist only around Buddha, with consciousness. Buddha lives. You can find what his psyche is, what his soul is. Ordinary man lives without a soul. Yes, you can find something wrong in his mechanism, and that wrong can be put right. What we know as psychology today is nothing but behaviorism. And in that sense, Pavlov and Skinner are far truer than Freud and Jung, because they think man is a machine. They are true about the man that exists, although they are not absolutely true, because they think this is the end. Man cannot be otherwise. That is their limitation. They think man can only be the machine. They are true as far as the present day man is concerned. Man is a machine. But they think that man cannot be otherwise. There they are wrong. But Freud and Jung and Adler are more wrong, because they think man is already on the earth. All that you need is to study man and you will know. But man is not there. It is a very unconscious phenomenon. Man is a myth. Let that be one of the most basic insights. It will help you to come out of the lie, out of the deception. Tantra is an effort to make you more conscious. The very word tantra means expansion of awareness. It comes from a Sanskrit root tan. Tan means expansion. Tantra means expansion of consciousness. And the basic fact, and the most fundamental fact to be understood is that you are fast asleep. You have to be awakened. Tantra believes in school methods. That has to be understood also. In that sense, Gurdjieff is one of the greatest tantrikas of this age. For example, if man is asleep, there is very less possibility that one can become awake alone. Look at it in this way. On the New Year day, you think, as you have always thought, and many New Year days have passed, and always you have taken a vow that never again you will smoke. And again the New Year has come, and you start thinking, this time it is going to happen. You take a vow that you will never smoke, but you don't go and tell it to others. You are afraid to. To say to others is dangerous, because you know yourself. Many times you have broken your vows. Then it is very humiliating. So you keep it to yourself. Now there are only one possibility out of 100 that the vow should be kept. 99 possibilities are that it will be broken sooner or later. You are an unconscious being. Your vow does not mean much. But if you go and you tell everybody in the town, friends, colleagues, children, wife. You go and tell everybody that I have taken a vow that I am not going to smoke. There are more possibilities, at least 10% that you will not smoke. First there was only one possibility, now there are 10 possibilities. 90% cases, 90% the possibility is that you will smoke. But non-smoking has more ground, more solidity. From 1% it has gone to 10%. But if you join a group of non-smokers, if you join a society of non-smokers, then the possibility is even more. 99% is the possibility that you will not smoke. What happens? When you are alone, you don't have any support from outside. You are alone. You can fall asleep easily. And nobody knows, so you are not worried either. When all know that their knowing will function to keep you more alert. Now your ego is at stake. Your respect and honor is at stake. But if you join a society of non-smokers, then the possibility is even more. Because you live through habits. Somebody takes his cigarette box out of his pocket and suddenly you start looking in your pocket. You are just mechanical. Somebody is smoking and you start thinking how beautiful it was to smoke. Nobody smokes. And you are in the society of non-smokers, then nobody will remind you. And the habit, by and by, will disappear out of no use. If a habit is not used, it by and by disappears. It tends to become dead. It loses grip on you. Tantra says men can become awake only through group methods. Through schools. That's why I insist so much for sannyas. Alone, you don't stand a chance. Together, much more possibility. It is as if 10 persons are lost in a desert. And it is very dangerous in the night. The enemies can kill them. The wild animals can kill them. The robbers can come. The murderers can come. It is very difficult. Now they decide on a group method. They say each one will be awake for 1 hour. To think that each one will be capable of remaining awake for 8 hours in the night is to ask too much from an unconscious man. But each one will remain awake for 1 hour. And before he starts falling asleep, he should make somebody else awake. Then there is more possibility that at least one of the group will be awake the whole night. Or, as Gurdjieff used to say, you are in a prison and you want to come out of the prison. Alone, there is not much chance. But if all the prisoners become a group, then there is much more chance. They can throw the guard. They can kill the guard. They can break the wall. If all the prisoners are together, then there is much more chance that they can come out into freedom. But the chances will increase even more if they are in contact with few people who are outside the prison, who are already free. That is the whole meaning of finding a master, finding somebody who is already outside the prison. He can be of tremendous help for many reasons. He can supply necessary things which will be needed for you to come out of the prison. He can send instruments, files, so that you can break out of the prison. He can watch from the outside and he can inform you when the guards change. In that interval, there is a possibility to get out. He can inform you when the guards fall asleep in the night. He can make arrangements so that the guards are drunk on one particular night. He can invite the jailer to his house for a party. He can do 1001 things which you cannot do from the inside. He can find support for you from the outside. He can create an atmosphere so when you are released from the jail, you will be accepted by the people. You will be sheltered, taken into houses. If the society is not ready to accept you from the outside, you may come out of the jail, but the society will deliver you back to the prison authorities. To be in contact with someone who is already awake is a must. And to be together with those people who are all thinking to become awake is also a must. This is the meaning of a school method, a group method. Tantra is a group method. It says be together. Find out all the possibilities. So many people can be together and they can pool their energies. Somebody is very intelligent and somebody is very loving. Both are half, but together they become more of a unity, more wholeness. Man is half, woman is half. Except Tantra. All the seekers have tried to do without the others. Man has tried alone, women have tried alone. Tantra says, why not be together, join hands together. The woman is half, the man is half. Together they are a greater energy, a more whole energy, a healthier energy. Join together. Let yin and yang function together. There will be more possibility to get out of it. Other methods use fight and conflict. Man starts fighting with women. He starts escaping from women. Rather than using the possibility of the help, he starts thinking as if the woman is the enemy. Tantra says this is sheer foolishness. You are wasting your energy unnecessarily fighting with the woman. Because there are greater things to be fought about. It is better to keep company with the woman. Let her help you. And you help her. Go together as one unit. And you have more chances to stand against the unconscious nature. Use all possibilities. Then only there is some chance that you can evolve into a conscious being. You can become a Buddha. Now the sutras. These are very significant sutras. First sutra. To a fly that likes the smell of putrid meat, the fragrance of sandalwood is foul. Beings who discard nirvana covet coarse sansara's realm. First thing, just as I said, man is a machine. Man lives out of habit, out of past, out of memories. Man lives out of knowledge that he has known, acquired before. So he goes on missing the new, and the truth is always the new. He is like a fly that likes the smell of putrid meat, foul and fetid odor. The fragrance of sandalwood is foul to that fly. She has a certain cast of memory, certain past. She has always thought that the putrid smell of meat is fragrance. That is her knowledge. That is her habit. That is her routine. That is her dead past. Now suddenly she comes across sandalwood. The fragrance of sandalwood will look to the fly as if it is a very foul and fetid odor. Don't be surprised. That's what is happening to you. If you have lived too much in the body, then even coming closer to a man who lives in his soul, and you will feel something is wrong. Coming to a Buddha, you will not feel the fragrance. You may even start feeling bad smell. Your interpretation. Otherwise, why people murdered Jesus? Jesus was a sandalwood, and people simply killed him. Why people poisoned Socrates? Socrates was sandalwood, but the flies. They understand their own past. They interpret according to their past. Just one day I was reading, a prostitute, the most famous prostitute of Athens, once came to Socrates. And there were sitting few people, just few people, just as here few people are sitting. And Socrates was talking to them. The prostitute looked around and said to Socrates, "Why? Such a great man like you and only so few people listening to you. I had thought whole Athens will be there. And I don't see the most respectable, the most honored, the politicians, the priests, the intellectuals, I don't see them here. What is the matter?" "Come, Socrates, someday to my house. You will find them standing in a queue." Socrates said, "You are right. Because you cater to a universal demand. I don't. You cater for a universal demand. I don't. I attract only few, chosen few. Others cannot feel my fragrance. They avoid. If even they come across me, they escape. They are afraid. It is a totally different fragrance," said Socrates. The prostitute must have been of tremendous intelligence. She looked into the eyes of the Socrates, bowed down and said, "Socrates, accept me as one of your friends." And never left. Became part of that Ismaili school. Must have been a woman of great awareness. So sudden a change. She understood it so immediately. But Athens killed Socrates. They did not like the man. The man looked very dangerous. Against him there were many charges. One was that he destroys people's beliefs, that he destroys young people's minds, that he is anarchic, that if he is allowed to live anymore, the society will be uprooted. He is the dangerous enemy. What he was doing? He was doing something totally different. He was trying to create a state of no mind. But the people thought he destroys people's mind. They are also right, the flies. Yes, young people were tremendously uptitted to Socrates. Because only young people can be attracted to such things. Only young has that courage. Even if old people come to me or to Socrates, they are young people only. That's why they come. Otherwise, they cannot come. An old, rotten mind cannot come to me. Maybe the body is old. But if an old man comes to me or an old woman, she comes only because she has still the youth of her soul. She is still young somewhere. Still she is able to understand the new, learn the new. They say you cannot teach an old dog new tricks. It is very difficult. The old dog knows old tricks and he goes on repeating them. It is very difficult to teach anything to an old mind. And these things are so radically different, so diametrically opposite to all that has been taught to you, that unless a man is really young, he cannot even listen. So young people were attracted. That was a sign that something of the eternal, something of the eternal youngness of the universe was pouring through Socrates. When Jesus is alive, you will find young people following him. You will not find young people going to see the Pope. Old people, dead people, long, long ago dead, they go to see them. When the original Shankaracharya was alive, you will find him, young people all around him. But to the Shankaracharya of Puri, only dead bodies, corpses here. Alive persons, you cannot find them. You can go and look into any temple, and you will find old women and old men. Youth is not there. In fact, whenever a religion is really there, youth is attracted. When truth is there, youth is attracted. When there are only lies left, doctrines, dogmas, creeds, then old people. When youth is attracted, that means truth is young. And youth is attracted. When truth is old, almost dead, then dead people are attracted. Old people are attracted only because of the fear of death. In old age, even atheists become theists, afraid. When a young man is attracted towards something, it is not because of the fear of death, because he does not know any death yet. It is because of tremendous love for life. And that is the difference between real religion and unreal religion. Unreal religion is fear-oriented. Real religion is love-oriented. You must have heard in all the languages of the world that ugly word exists, God-fearing. that must have been coined by dead, dull old people. God fearing? How one can fear God? And if you fear God, how can you love Him? Out of fear, never love. Only hatred can arise. Out of fear, you can be against God, because He will be your enemy. How can you love Him? And if you love Him, how can you be afraid? Have you ever been afraid of the person you love? Have you ever been afraid of your mother if you love her? Have you been ever afraid of your woman if you love her? If you love, there is no fear. Love casteth out all fear. God loving. Romantically in love with God. Ecstatically in love with God. But that is possible only for the young mind. Whether the young mind is in the young body or in the old body, that is irrelevant. But it is possible only for the young mind. Now Socrates is punished because he attracted young people. Buddha is punished because he attracted young people. But always remember, whenever a religion is born, young people rush from all corners of the world. This would be the symbol that something has happened. When old people are rushing somewhere, you can be certain nothing is happening there. That is not where the action is. Where young people are going, that is the place where action is. But to a fly that likes the smell of putrid meat, the fragrance of sandalwood is foul. Beings who discard nirvana covet coarse samsara's realm. Truth is the unknown, the mysterious. You cannot approach it through your past habit. You can approach it only when you are naked of all habits. The Christian priest's robe is called the habit. It is a beautiful use of the word habit. Yes, I say when you are nude of all habits, naked of all habits, all dresses are dropped. You function not through memory, but through awareness. These are two different functions. You function through memory, then you don't see that which is. You go on seeing that which you have seen before. You go on interpreting the present in terms of the past. You go on imposing something which is not there. You go on seeing things which are not, and you go on not seeing things which are. Memory has to be put aside. Memory is good. Use it. But truth has never been known through memory. How can you know truth through memory? You have never known truth in the past. Truth is not known. Truth is a stranger. You will have to put all memory aside. You will have to say to your mind, keep quiet. Let me see without you. Let me look only with clarity, not with clouded eyes. No thoughts, no beliefs, no scriptures, no philosophies, no religions. Let me look directly, immediately. Let me look here now. Let me look into that which is confronting me. Only then you are in tune with the mystery of truth. And remember, truth never becomes a memory. Even when you have known it, it never becomes a memory. Truth is so vast, it cannot be contained by the memory. And whenever it will be again there, and you will know it, it will be again new. It is never old. It is always new. It is always fresh. That is one of its qualities, that it never becomes old. It is always young. So if you want to know the truth, Sarha says to the king, "Sir, if you really want to know the truth, what has happened to me, you put aside your mind. I know you are just like a fly. You have lived a life of body and mind. You don't know anything beyond them. Here standing I am. I am beyond both. And there is no way to explain it to you according to your mind. No, it cannot be explained. If you really want to experience it, you can experience it, but it cannot be explained. God cannot be defined. God cannot be explained. Please remember, never explain it, because if you explain it, you will be explaining it away. God cannot be contained by any thoughts, but God can be lived. God can be loved. You can become gods, that is possible. But the mind cannot contain the God. Mind is a very small container. It is like a teaspoon. And you want to have the Pacific Ocean in the teaspoon? Yes, you can have a little salty water in your teaspoon. But that won't give the idea of the Pacific, of the vastness. Storms won't happen in your teaspoon. Great waves will not arise. Yes, it will taste alike, but it will not be an ocean. Sarha says, if you want to see me, sir, you will have to put your mind aside. You have a fly's mind. You have certain habits of thinking, of feeling. You have certain habits of living. You have lived a life of body and mind. And at the most, whatsoever you have known up to now is just heard by you. You have read scriptures. Sarha himself was reading scriptures to the king before. He knows it well. He knows what the king knows. His knowledge is just information. Sarha says, it has happened to me. But to see it, you will need a different quality of seeing. Mind never meets the truth, never encounters the truth. The ways of the mind and the ways of the truth are absolutely separate. It is a separate reality. Hence the insistence of all the mystics of the world to attain to a state of no mind. That's what meditation is all about, a state of no mind. A state of non-thinking, yet fully aware, luminous with awareness. When there is not a single thought, your sky is clean of all clouds. And then the sun shines bright. Ordinarily we are clouded with so many thoughts, desires, ambitions, dreams, that the sun cannot shine. It hides behind those dark clouds. Desire is a cloud, thought is a cloud, imagination is a cloud, and one needs to be unclouded to know that which is. Sarha says, beings who discard nirvana covet core sansara's realm. Sansara means to live as body, as mind, as ego. Sansara means to live outwards. Sansara means to live with things. Sansara means to live with the idea that all is matter and nothing else. Sansara means three poisons: power, prestige, pull. To live in the world with the idea of having more power, more prestige, more money, more pull, this and that. To live in things and for things. That is the meaning of the word sansara. The world. Just watch yourself. Have you ever lived with persons? Or you live only with things? Is your wife a person or a thing? Is your husband a person or a thing? Do you treat your husband as a person, as a superbly, intrinsically valuable person, or just as a utility, that he is the provider of bread and butter? Or sees the housekeeper, looks after the children? Is your wife an end unto herself, or is she just a utility, a commodity to be used? Sometimes you use her sexually, sometimes you use her in other ways, but using a person means the person is a thing to you, not a person. A person cannot be used. Only things can be used. A person cannot be purchased. Only things can be purchased. A person has such tremendous value, such divinity, such dignity. How can you use a person? Yes, he can give out of her or his love, but you cannot use. And you have to be thankful. Have you ever been thankful to your wife? Have you ever been thankful to your father, to your mother? Have you ever been thankful to your friends? Sometimes you are thankful to a stranger, but never to your own people, because you take them for granted. To live with things is to live in sansara. To live with persons is to live in nirvana. And once you start living with persons, things start disappearing. Ordinarily, even persons are reduced to be things. And when a person starts becoming meditative, even things start becoming persons. Even a tree becomes a person. A rock becomes a person. Everything by and by starts having a personality. Because God is spread all over the existence. Sarha says, "Sir, you have lived into sansara and you cannot understand the way of nirvana. If you really want to understand it, you will have to live it. There is no other way. To know, you will have to taste something of it. And I am here standing before you. And you are asking explanations. Nirvana is standing in front of you. And you are asking theories. Not only that, you must be utterly blind. You have come to persuade me to come back to your sansara. A fly is persuading me to leave the forest of sandalwood and its fragrance for the putrid smell of meat Have you gone mad? Said Sarha to the king. Let me persuade you to come to my world, rather than you persuading me to come to your world. I have known your world, and I have known this new reality too. I can compare. You have known only your world. You don't know my reality. You can't compare. When a Buddha says, this world is illusory, meditate over it, because he has known this world too. When some atheist, materialist, some communist says that the world of nirvana is just illusory, there is no need to bother about it at all, because he has not known it. He knows only this world. You cannot trust his assertions about the other world. He has never meditated. He has never entered into it. Look at it. All those who have meditated, not a single one has denied the inner reality. Not a single one. Unexceptionally, all the meditators have become mystics. Those who have not meditated, they know only the world of the fly and the world of the foul and fetid odor of putrid meat. They live in the rotten world of things, but they know only that. And certainly their statements cannot be trusted upon. A Buddha can be trusted. A Christ can be trusted. A Mahavira can be trusted. They have known both. They have known the lower and the higher. And by knowing the higher, they say something about the lower, which has to be meditated. Don't reject it outrightly. For example, Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, Mao, they have never meditated. And they say there is no God. Now, it is almost as if a man has never gone to the lab of the scientist and says something about science. A man who has never went into the lab and says that the theory of relativity is just mumbo jumbo, it cannot be relied upon. You have to go to the lab. You have to go into higher mathematics. You have to prove it. Just because you cannot understand it, you cannot be allowed to deny it. There are very few people who understand the theory of relativity. It was said when Einstein was alive that there was only 12 persons alive who understood his theory all over the world. And there are few people who think that is an exaggeration, that number is not right. Even 12 persons were not there to understand his theory correctly. But because of that, you cannot say it is not right. You cannot take a vote about it. You cannot defeat it in an election. You will have to go through the same processes. Now, Marx saying there is no God is simply a stupid statement. Never meditated, never contemplated, never prayed. His statement is irrelevant. Those who have meditated, those who have dug a little deeper into their being, they have come to the same truths. Beings who discard nirvana, covet court sansara's realm, Saraha is saying, you discard nirvana and you go on rushing after illusions. You have come to persuade me, sir. Look at me, how ecstatic I am. Look at me. I am not the same person who had left your court. I am totally a different person. He is trying to bring the king's awareness to the present moment, and he succeeded. He must have been a man of great prescience. He pulled the king out of the world of the flies, out of the world of putrid meat. He pulled him to the world of the sandalwood and its fragrance. The second sutra, an ox footprints filled with water will soon dry up. So with a mind that is firm but full of qualities that are not perfect, these imperfections will in time dry up. He says, look, an ox has walked and there is a footprint on the land, and the footprint is filled with water, rainwater. How long it will be there? Sooner or later it will evaporate, and the ox footprint filled with water will not be there anymore. But the ocean is always. Although the water in the ox footprint is also from the ocean, but something is different. The ocean always remains, never increasing, never decreasing. Great clouds arise out of it. It never decreases. Great rivers pour their waters into it. It never increases. It remains always the same. But this small footprint of an ox is full of water right now. Within hours or days, it will be gone. It will dry up. So is the skull of human mind. It is just an ox footprint, such a small thing. Just a little water is there. Don't trust it too much. It is already drying up. It will disappear. The skull is a very small thing. Don't think that you can contain the universe in the skull. And it can only be temporary. It can never be the eternal. An ox footprints filled with water will soon dry up. So with a mind that is firm but full of qualities that are not perfect, these imperfections will in time dry up. What you are keeping in your small skull, what are the contents? Desires, dreams, ambitions, thoughts, imagination, will, emotions. These are the things that you are keeping as content. They all will dry up. All contents will dry up. So change the emphasis from the contents to the container. That is the whole secret of Tantra. Look at the container and don't look at the content. The sky is full of clouds. Don't look at the clouds. Look at the sky. Don't look what is there in your head, what is there in your mind. Just look at your consciousness. Emotion is there, anger is there, love is there, greed is there, fear is there, jealousy is there. These are contents. Just behind them is the infinite sky of consciousness. A man who lives through the contents lives the life of a machine. And the man who starts changing his emphasis from the contents to the container starts living the life of awareness, of Buddhahood. And says Sarha, sir, these contents that you are having in your mind will soon dry up. Look at that ox footprint. Your head is not bigger than that. The skull is not bigger than that. But your consciousness is infinite. Now this has to be understood. Emotions are in your head, but consciousness is not in your head. In fact, your head is in your consciousness. Consciousness is vast, infinite. Emotions, desires, ambitions are in your head. They will dry up. But even when your head has completely dropped and disappeared into the earth, your consciousness will not disappear. You don't contain the consciousness in you. The consciousness contains you. It is bigger than you. There are people who ask, sometimes somebody comes to me and asks, where is the soul in the human body, in the heart, in the navel, in the head, where is the soul? They think they are asking a very pertinent question. It is nowhere in the body. Your body is in the soul. The soul is a bigger phenomenon than your body. The soul surrounds you. And your soul and my soul are not different. We live in the existence. We live in one soul's ocean. One soul surrounds us, within and without. It is all one energy. I don't have a different soul and you don't have a different soul. We have different bodies. It is almost like the electricity running into the bulb and running into the radio and running into the TV and moving the fan and doing thousand and one things. The fan is different from the bulb, but the electricity that runs is the same. We are one energy. Our expressions are different, but our reality is one. If you look at the content, if I look at the content, then my dreams are different from yours, certainly. We cannot share our dreams. I have my ambitions, you have your ambitions. And not only that we cannot share our dreams are in conflict. My ambition is against your ambition. Your ambition is against my ambition. But if we forget the contents and just look at consciousness, pure consciousness, cloudless sky, then where is you and where I? We are one. In that moment there is unity. And in that moment there is universal consciousness. All consciousness is universal. Unconsciousness is private. Consciousness is universal. The day you become really a man, you are a universal man. That is the meaning of Christ. Universal man. Son of God. That is the meaning of Buddha. Universal man. Have come to total and absolute awareness. Man as a machine is different. This has to be understood. If you are having kidney trouble, I am not having. If I am having a headache, you are not having the headache. Even if you love me, you cannot share the headache. Even if I love you, I cannot have your pain. But if we two are sitting together and meditating, and a moment comes when I have no content in my mind, and you also don't have any content in your mind, we will not be two. Meditators begin as separate but end as one. If you all are sitting in meditation here, listening to me, then you are not many, then you are one. Then you are not only one, the speaker and the listener are not separate. Then we are bridged together. 20 meditators in a room meditating, when they come to real meditation, are no more 20. There is only one meditative quality in the room. There is a story. Few people came to see Buddha. Ananda was sitting on guard outside the room. But those people took so long time that Ananda became worried. Many times he looked in, but they continued and continued and continued. Then he came inside the room to see what is happening. And there he found nobody, just Buddha sitting. So he asked Buddha where those fellows have gone. And there is no other door, and I am sitting on the only one door. So where they have gone? And Buddha said, they are meditating. It is a beautiful story. They all fell into meditation. And Ananda could not see them because he was not still a meditator. He could not see this new phenomenon, this total shift of energy. They were not theirs, because they were not as their bodies theirs, they were not as their minds theirs. Those egos dissolved. Ananda could see only what he could see. A new reality has happened. A great king once came to see Buddha. His prime minister persuaded him to come, but he was a very suspicious man, as politicians and kings are usually. Very suspicious. He didn't want to come in the first place. Just out of political reasons he came to see. Because in the capital the rumor was spreading that he is against Buddha. And the whole people were for Buddha, so he became afraid. It was not diplomatic. So he went to see with his prime minister. When he reached closer to the group where Buddha was sitting with his 10,000 monks, he became very much afraid. He pulled his sword out and he said to the prime minister, "What is the matter? Because you said 10,000 people are staying there, and we have come so close, and there is no noise. Is there some conspiracy?" The prime minister laughed and he said, "You don't know Buddha's people. You just put your sword back. You come on. There is no conspiracy and nothing. You need not be afraid. We are not going to kill you. You don't know Buddha's men." But very suspicious, holding his hand on the sword, the king went into the group. He was surprised. He could not believe there were 10,000 people sitting under the trees silently, as if there was no one. He asked Buddha, "This is a miracle. 10,000 people, even 10 people together create so much noise. What these people are doing? What has happened to these people? Has something gone wrong? Are they still alive? They look like statues. And what they are doing here sitting They said, do something. And Buddha said, they are doing something, but it has nothing to do with the outside. They are doing something in their inner world. They are not in their bodies. They are in their beings, at the very core. And these are not 10,000 people right now. They are all part of one consciousness. The third sutra, like salt sea water that turns sweet when drunk up by the clouds, so a firm mind that works for others turns the poison of sense objects into nectar. The basic tantra attitude is, the sensual can be transformed into the sublime. Matter can be transformed into mind. The unconscious can be transformed into consciousness. Modern physics says matter can be transformed into energy, energy can be transformed into matter. In fact, they are not two. The same energy, functioning as two forms. Tantra says sex can be transformed into samadhi. The same approach, very basic and fundamental. The lower can be transformed into the higher. Because lower and higher are joined together, it is a ladder. They are never separate, nowhere separate. There is no gap between them. You can move from the lower to the higher, you can move from the higher to the lower. And that ladder is what man is. He can exist on the lowest rung. That is his decision. He can move upwards. He can exist on the highest rung. He can exist as a beast, or he can exist as a Buddha. Both are his two rungs, the lowest and the highest. And man is a ladder. He can fall into deep unconsciousness and become a rock. And he can rise to absolute consciousness and can become a god. But both are not separate. That is the beauty of Tantra. Tantra is non-divisive. Tantra is the only religion which is not schizophrenic. Tantra is the only religion which is really sane, the sanest religion, because it doesn't divide. If you divide, you create a split. If you tell to people that body is bad, that body is the enemy, that body has to be condemned, that body is in the service of the devil, then you are creating a split in man. Then the man becomes afraid of the body. And then there is, by and by, is created an unbridgeable gulf. And he is pulled into two parts. He is torn into opposite directions. The body pulls into the body. The mind tries to pull into the mind. There is a conflict and confusion. Tantra says, you are one. There is no need to have any confusion. You can be fused in one reality. There is no need to have any conflict. There is no need to be torn apart. There is no need to go insane. You can love all that is available and you can evolve it with deep love, care, creativity. It can be evolved. The body is not the enemy of your soul. The body is just the seat of your soul. The body is just the temple. It is your abode. It is not the enemy, it is your friend. Tantra drops all sorts of violence. Not only violence with others, but violence with oneself. Tantra says love reality in its totality. Yes, much can be evolved, but all evolution is through love. And there is no need to fight. Like salt sea water that turns sweet when drunk up by the clouds, you cannot drink the salt sea water. It is so salty. It is all salt. You will die if you drink the salt, salty sea water. But when a cloud comes and draws the water from the sea, it turns into sweet, and then you can drink. Sarha says, Samadhi is like a cloud. Meditative energy is like a cloud which turns your sexuality into higher realms, which turns your physical existence into non-physical, which turns the salty, bitter experiences of the world into sweet, nectar-like experiences of nirvana. The samsara itself becomes nirvana if you can create the cloud that transforms it. That cloud, Buddha actually has called it Dharma Megha Samadhi. The samadhi of the cloud of the fundamental law, Dharma Megha Samadhi. You can create that cloud. That cloud is created by meditation. You go on intensely meditating, dropping thoughts, dropping desires, ambitions. By and by, your consciousness is a burning fire. That cloud is there. Now you can transform anything through that fire. That fire transmutes. That fire is alchemical. Through meditation, the lower becomes higher. The baser metal is turned into gold. Like salt sea water that turns sweet when drunk up by the clouds, so a firm mind that works for others turns the poison of sense objects into nectar. Two things. First, one has to create a cloud of meditation into one's being. And the second thing is compassion. One who works for others. Buddha insists on two things, meditation and compassion, prajna and karuna. He says sometimes it happens a meditator can become too much selfish. Then too something goes sour. Meditate, delight, but share the delight. Go on sharing it. Don't hold it. Because once you start holding, ego starts arising. Never hold anything. The moment you get it, give it. And you will be getting more and more and more. The more you give, the more you get. Then everything becomes nectar. Everything is nectar. Just we have to know how to turn it. We have to know the alchemy. The last sutra, if ineffable, never is one unsatisfied. If unimaginable, it must be bliss itself. Though from a cloud one fears the thunderclap, the crops ripen when from it pours the rain. The ineffable. Sarha says, don't ask me what it is. It is ineffable, it cannot be said. It cannot be expressed. No language exists which can express it, but it can be experienced. Look at my contentment. Look how satisfied I have become. You have known me before too. How restless I was. How unsatisfied with everything. And all was available. I was your favorite. All was available to me. Yet I was not satisfied. Now look, I am standing in a cemetery ground. Not even a roof on my head. And I don't live with kings and queens. I live with this Aerosmith woman. But look into my eyes, how contented I am. Can't you see something ineffable has happened? Can't you feel my wife? Are you so dull and dead that you need explanations? If ineffable, never is one unsatisfied. That is the only criterion. Whether a man has attained to truth or not, he will be never unsatisfied. His contentment is absolute. You cannot drag him out of his contentment. You cannot make him discontented. Whatsoever happens, he remains the same contented. Success or failure, life or death, friends are no friends, lovers are no lovers, it makes no difference. His tranquility, his stillness is utterly absolute. He is centered. If ineffable, never is one unsatisfied. If that which cannot be said has happened, then there is only one way to know it, and that way is to see the contentment. If unimaginable, it must be bliss itself. And I know, he says, you cannot imagine what has happened to me. How can you imagine? Because you have never known it. Imagination is always repeating the same that you have known. You can imagine happiness. You have known bits and pieces of it. You can imagine unhappiness. You have known it, a lot of it. You can imagine happiness even if you don't know happiness. You can imagine it as the contrary of unhappiness. But how can you imagine bliss? You have not known it. And there is nothing as contrary to it. It is not a duality. It is impossible to imagine. So Sarha says, I can understand you cannot imagine it. But I am not saying to imagine it. Look. It is present here now. And if you cannot imagine it, that also is one of the criterions of truth. Truth cannot be imagined. It can be seen, but not imagined. You can have a vision of it, but you cannot dream about it. And that is the difference between a dream and a vision. Dream is yours, vision is not yours. Christ saw God, and the scriptures say he saw the vision. Now the psychoanalyst will say it was just a dream. He does not know the difference between a dream and a vision. A dream is yours. You were imagining. You created it. It was your fantasy. A vision is something out of the blue that you have never thought about. Not even a part of it has ever been thought by you. It is so utterly new. Then it is a vision. Vision is from God. Dream is from your mind. If unimaginable, it must be bliss itself. Look at me. You cannot imagine what has happened. Can't you see it? You have eyes to see. Look, watch, hold my hand. Come closer to me. Just be vulnerable to me, so my vibration can vibrate your being. And the unimaginable and the ineffable can be experienced. Though from a cloud one fears the thunder clap, and Sarha says, I know he must have seen the being a little afraid. I see every day people come to me and I see them trembling, afraid, fearful, and they say, we are afraid, Bhagwan. I know Sarha must have seen the king is trembling deep inside, maybe not on the outside, he was a great king, a very disciplined man he must have been, he must be standing erect, but deep down he must be afraid. It always happens when you are close by, like a man, Sarha-like man or Buddha-like man, you are bound to be afraid. Just the other night a young man came and he said, but why am I afraid of you? You have not done anything wrong to me. Why am I afraid of you? I love you certainly, but why am I afraid of you? It is natural. When you come close to an abyss, what do you expect? You will be afraid. There is every possibility you may fall into it and will not be able to recover yourself again. It is going to be irrecoverable, completely, utterly gone. You will be in it. You will not be able to recapitulate. Fear is natural. Sarha says, though from a cloud one fears the thunder clap. He says, I am like a cloud and you are afraid because of the thunder clap of the lightning. But remember, the crops ripen when from it pours the rain. But if you allow me to rain on you, the seeds will sprout, sir. And the man that is still hidden behind you, is still not yet born, will be born. You will be able to ripen, to mature. You will be able to blossom. I invite you, says Sarha, for a great harvest. The harvest of consciousness. The harvest of awareness. Enough for today.